Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 39, This Means War, in which we look at the unpleasantness of chemical warfare in the first half of the 20th century. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. In previous episodes, I have referred to research interrupted by the Great War. Certain chemical products like airplane dope, produced for the Great War, built a foundation for explosives used in the Great War, and even a chemist's death in the Great War. Therefore, it's time we examine the First Chemical War, the Great War, or World War I. World War I started on July 28, 1914, when the Austro-Hungarian Empire declared war on Serbia as a response to the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand by a Serbian nationalist. Within a month, much of the world had aligned itself with the Allies or the Axis. Chemicals used early on in World War I included the standard array from the 19th century, including gunpowder, picric acid-related substances, and so on. We already heard about the British government inviting the brothers Dreyfus to build a factory to manufacture airplane dope, a protective lacquer for early cloth-covered airplanes. But something new happened on April 22, 1915, near the town of Ypres in Belgium. At this time, the German military unleashed a new weapon, gas warfare. At 5 p.m. that sunny day, troops saw a haze of greenish-yellow gas rising near the German trenches. The cloud of gas floated towards the southwest, and French soldiers were sent staggering. About 168 tons of chlorine gas were used along a four-mile stretch, and the German Reserve Corps were attacking during that chlorine attack, the first weapon of mass destruction. How did this come about? Remember the electrochemist Walter Nernst? He was a driver volunteering for the German army and viewed the deadlock in the trenches. No one was going anywhere, either advancing or retreating. He suggested using tear gas in artillery shells to cause the enemy to flee. After a field test, another German chemist, Fritz Haber, proposed using a different chemical, chlorine, a diatomic molecule, because it's heavier and would sink into the trenches, driving the soldiers out. Chemically, the chlorine gas would lock the valves on cylinders, so the second method was to hold the chlorine as a liquid and soldiers would siphon the liquid out and it would disperse via the wind. But instead of driving the soldiers out, it wounded and killed them. This was the first successful use of chemical warfare, killing 5,000 Allied soldiers and wounding an additional 15,000 more. Captain Alfred Pollard, in his 1932 memoirs, said, "Dusk was falling when from the German trenches in front of the French line rose that strange green cloud of death. The light northeasterly breeze wafted it toward them, and in a moment death had them by the throat. One cannot blame them that they broke and fled. In the gathering dark of that awful night, they fought with the terror, running blindly in the gas cloud and dropping with breasts heaving in agony and the slow poison of suffocation mantling their dark faces. Hundreds of them fell and died. Others lay helpless, froth upon their agonized lips and their racked bodies powerfully sick, with tearing nausea at short intervals. They too would die later, a slow and lingering death of agony unspeakable. The whole air was tainted with the acrid smell of chlorine that caught at the back of men's throats and filled their mouths with its metallic taste." This caused a technological race by both sides to find better gas masks. In the meantime, the United States Center for Disease Control notes that chlorine gas is toxic because it is a strong oxidant. It grabs electrons from other atoms. It pulls hydrogen ions from water in tissue, releasing oxygen and HCl to cause tissue damage. Damage occurs to the lungs, skin, and eyes. After that April attack, the British finally retaliated with their own gas attack of 140 tons of chlorine at the Battle of Loos in France on September 25th. That gas warfare didn't work because the wind blew much of the gas back toward British troops. By December, the French upped the ante and let loose phosgene gas, COCl2. It's 6 times deadlier than chlorine, and it is invisible, unlike chlorine. Often it was mixed with chlorine to help it spread because phosgene is heavier than chlorine. It also smells like moldy hay. Soldiers didn't realize what happened because phosgene's effects take a day or so to appear, and then treatment is fruitless. Here the gas attacks proteins, specifically the hydroxide, amine, and thiol groups common in protein molecules, especially the lungs. An even further escalation was the use of mustard gas, dichloroethyl sulfide, so it has the chlorine and sulfur atoms. First used by the Germans on July 12, 1917, this compound smells like garlic or horseradish. Technically, it's a viscous liquid, not a gas, and is dispersed as a fine mist or aerosol. It reacts to form alkylating agents on DNA nucleotides, so it destroys the ability of cells to reproduce and can also cause cancer. It forms blisters on skin and lungs. It can also last a few weeks out in the open, so it forces an army to withdraw from contaminated land. A fourth and final compound was Lewisite, named after military chemist Winfred Lewis, and the substance was codenamed G34. A factory in Ohio began production on November 1, 1918, but the war ended within a couple of weeks, so it was never used. It's an organoarsenic compound with 3 chlorines. Impure Lewisite smells vaguely like geraniums, and it was designed to be a blister-producing agent and lung irritant. The USA did stockpile Lewisite, but by 2012, all of it was destroyed. The horrors of the Great War haunted many, and resulted in the Geneva Protocol in 1925, which explicitly listed as illegal, quote, asphyxiating, poisonous, or other gases, unquote. Let's look at a mixture of chemistry and politics possibly resulting from the Great War. Chaim Weizmann was born in the Russian Empire in the town of Motala in current Belarus. By high school, he was talented in chemistry, and for college he went to Darmstadt in Germany. Russian universities had a severe quota system, allowing almost no Jews to attend. By 1899, he received a doctorate in chemistry from Freiburg University in Switzerland on synthetic dyes, a popular topic at the time, as we know. One of his colleagues soon thereafter was the chemist Karl Graebe, whom we mentioned in a previous episode. Eventually, he made his way to Manchester, England, where he became a British subject. While at the university, his research figured out how to use bacterial fermentation to make commercial amounts of chemicals. In particular, he was able to coax his bacterial cultures to synthesize acetone. Where have we heard about acetone before? In the manufacture of cordite, a smokeless explosive. The Great War broke out, and suddenly the British government needed vast amounts of cordite for the war effort, but supply was eliminated because the Germans had overrun those European suppliers. So His Majesty's government used Weizmann's fermentation technique for synthetic acetone. Weizmann's work won the admiration of the British, who had just taken over the eastern Mediterranean area from the Turks during the war. Weizmann also was a fervent Zionist, with the idea that the original land of Israel is the rightful site of a Jewish homeland. He was able to influence Lord Balfour, Lord of the Admiralty, to issue the Balfour Declaration in November 1917, which says, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. 31 years later, the State of Israel was founded when the British gave up their mandate, and Dr. Weizmann was elected the first president of Israel in February 1949. So never let it be said that chemistry and politics don't mix. But politics and chemistry also can take a dark turn. Recall a bit earlier in this episode when I mentioned Walter Nernst, who proposed driving out Allied troops from their trenches with tear gas shells. His idea was overridden by another famous German chemist named Fritz Haber, who chose chlorine instead. Fritz Haber already was a world-famous chemist by the onset of the Great War. Throughout the 19th century, as population grew, agriculture needed to keep up, and with it, fertilizers. At the time, much of the fertilizer was guano, accumulated bird droppings from South America, for the nitrogen component. The obvious chemical method to supplement this was to extract nitrogen from the air. But the diatomic molecule N2 in the atmosphere is extremely stable and difficult to dissociate into a usable form. Fritz Haber and his British assistant, Robert Le Rossignol, tackled this problem and unveiled their answer in 1909, the Haber process. Let's go back to the reaction to fix atmospheric nitrogen to ammonia, one molecule of N2 plus three molecules of H2 hydrogen gas gives two molecules of ammonia, NH3. The enthalpy is negative 92 kilojoules, so heat is released. At first glance, you might guess that this is a spontaneous reaction, except for the entropy factor. We start with four molecules of gas and end up with two molecules of gas, a decrease of entropy, so unfavored to move forward. Haber used Le Chatelier's principle, in that if you change the conditions of the system, it tries to regain equilibrium. He squeezed the reactants under immense pressure, 100 atmospheres, and heated it to over 400 degrees Celsius. This shifted the equilibrium forward towards ammonia, which is only two molecules of product versus four molecules of reactant, so that the pressure in the vessel lowered when the forward reaction ran. He also included catalysts, powders of iron, to lower the activation energy as per Ostwald. The process worked, and it is used to this day as a source of ammonia for fertilizer. Haber became famous for this method. But now, Haber promoted chlorine gas as a supposedly humane method of warfare. His wife, Clara Immervar, also a chemist and the first woman to get a PhD from Breslau University, was so upset by his work that she called it, quote, a perversion of the ideals of science, unquote. Eventually, she committed suicide using his army pistol because of his attitude. By the end of the Great War, Haber was given the Nobel Prize for his work on fixing nitrogen as ammonia. There was a huge controversy and outcry because of Haber's work on chemical warfare, and his life spiraled downward over the next 15 years. Legend has it that Ernest Rutherford refused to shake Haber's hand in congratulations. His own son, Ludwig Haber, wrote a book in 1986 called The Poisonous Cloud, A History of Gas Warfare During the Great War. The horrible acts of chemical warfare threw a chill onto chemical research in the 1920s and 1930s. Thousands of wounded veterans showed the public firsthand the results of the first chemists' war. I have copies of Soviet Yiddish texts from about 1930 warning citizens over the next great war, the Chemische Kampf, or chemical struggle. As I mentioned, the Geneva Protocol banned chemical weaponry, but it occasionally reappeared in use. I have read that the early Soviets themselves used poison gases in 1921 to put down a rebellion. Spanish and French used mustard gas and phosgene on Berbers from 1924 to 1927. Italy used such gas in Libya starting in 1928 and then trotted them out for what's called the Second Italo-Ethiopian War in 1935. By December, the Ethiopians cut off lines for supplies to the Italian armies, so the fascists retaliated by dropping mustard gas bombs and spray tanks. Use of chemical weapons lasted until April 1936. Both countries signed on to the Geneva Protocol, but Italy maintained that chemical weapons were allowed if enemies committed atrocities. As a side note, the USA didn't agree to the Geneva Protocol until 1975. We also know that the Japanese Empire, during its invasion of China in the late 1930s, used mustard gas starting at least by 1939. In December 1936, at the German chemical conglomerate IG Farben, a chemist contracted by the Nazis, Gerhard Schrader, was searching for an effective insecticide to preserve stores of food. The compounds he was experimenting with are called organophosphates, which have a central phosphorus atom surrounded by oxygens, some connected to organic parts. The organophosphates interrupt insects' nervous systems. But Schrader also discovered that the chemical he was studying, preparation 9/91, was immensely toxic to all mammals. IG Farben notified the Nazis who analyzed this chemical. They were so shocked by how toxic it was that they named it Tabun, a taboo to use it. There is a messenger molecule called acetylcholine that travels from the brain to your muscles to initiate contraction. After it is used, an enzyme called acetylcholinesterase destroys the molecule. Tabun blocks the enzyme, so the muscle keeps contracting forever. Hence, Tabun is a nerve agent. Then Schrader went further and, in June 1939, found another compound doubly toxic, substance 146, which the Nazis renamed sarin after the developers, Schrader, Ambrose, Ritter, and Linde, using the IN from inside Linde. The Nazis also worked on weaponizing it for World War II had started. But by 1943, Hitler vetoed the project, perhaps because he was a victim of mustard gas as a veteran of World War I. There is a series of nerve agents called the G-series after the Germans who developed them. Among more recent times, these G-series nerve agents were used in Iraq in March 1988, when Saddam Hussein dropped chemical bombs on Halabja to kill Kurds, then a month later to kill Iranian soldiers. Japan in 1994 and 95, when two religious sects killed and injured others. And Syria in 2013 and 2017 to kill opposers of the Syrian regime. There are other series of nerve agents, which I hope to discuss in a future episode. Another weapon the Nazis used for genocidal purposes was hydrogen cyanide, HCN. Originally, hydrogen cyanide was employed as a pesticide around the turn of the 20th century, when it was processed packaged and sold under the trade name Zyklon, Z-Y-K-L-O-N. It released HCN when exposed to heat and water, and was banned after the Great War. The product, however, was revived in the 1920s by the German chemical firm Degussa, its descendant is now Evonik, under the direction of chemist Bruno Tesch. The new version of Zyklon was in canisters, including an eye irritant as a warning of its presence in the air, plus Kieselgur as an adsorbent. The new product was called Zyklon B and was employed for fumigation and delousing. Then the Nazis got their hands on Zyklon B and deployed it in their concentration camps as a murder weapon in gas chambers. The result was 1.1 million people killed by the Nazis. After the war, Tesch was tried because he deliberately sold Zyklon B to the Nazis specifically to kill people. He was the only businessman tried and executed for crimes against humanity. In our next episode, scientists figure out what polymers really are, and the age of polymers finally moves ahead. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.